I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Maryland Senator Ben Cardin is now the ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, and this week he faces an early challenge of his skills as a negotiator. Republican senators and some Democrats are expected to demand that Congress be given authority over lifting sanctions against Iran, a key part of the tentative deal on Iran's nuclear program announced by President Obama. Senator Cardin is right in the middle of this high-stakes confrontation between lawmakers and the White House, with Israel, whose leaders oppose any deal, watching closely. Senator Cardin is our guest this hour. We'll ask him about the Iran deal, as well as his proposal to overhaul the federal tax system, and about Hillary Clinton's long-anticipated announcement that she is again a candidate for president. First, the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for making Midday part of your day. In the second hour of our show today, some American history for you, looking back 150 years to the end of the Civil War and the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Not so much about the assassination, but how people reacted to it, North and South. We have two excellent historians who will be joining us. Martha Hodes, who's just written a book for Yale University Press, called Mourning Lincoln. She got access to diaries and letters, the private things people had to say about the death of the president, both North and South. And Adam Goodhart will be joining us. He's a lecturer in history from Washington College. He's already written an acclaimed book on the Civil War. He'll be joining us for the second hour as well. He retraced Abraham Lincoln's train that took the president's body, its casket, from Washington back to Springfield. That'll be in the second hour of our show. Senator Ben Cardin is with us in this hour of the show. Earlier this month, the ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez, was charged with 14 counts of corruption. And after being charged in that federal case, Senator Menendez took a hiatus from his position as ranking member on the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And that's where Senator Ben Cardin now finds himself. He has replaced Menendez as the top Democrat in the committee at a time when the committee is embroiled in a high-stakes confrontation with the Obama White House over the tentative deal with Iran over that country's nuclear program. So we'll start off by welcoming Senator Cardin back to Midday, and we'll talk about that. Senator, nice to see you.
Dan, it's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you very much. Yes. Great to have you stop by and actually be with us in the studio, and we open the phone lines to our listeners. You just got off the phone with the White House discussing this very thing, eh?
I've been in touch with the White House rather regularly over the last, I guess, 10 days since the agreements were reached. They've been very open with me, very clear about what they need. I think all of us want the president to succeed. That is, we want Iran to give up its nuclear weapon ambitions. And we want our president to be as strong in negotiations as possible. So I am trying to use my position as now the ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee to bridge some of the gaps that exist in Congress. Senator Corker, the chairman of the committee, is a person who is one of very high integrity, and it's been a pleasure to work with him, and we're trying to resolve some differences.
Some things that we need to catch up on when it comes to this. Of course, this issue has been around for several years. They've been trying to reach some sort of a negotiation, some kind of a deal with Iran for years. So for our listeners here to understand what's at stake here, and also to sort out some of the noise, the freshest noise from this morning, Jeffrey Goldberg interviewing Senator Tom Cotton, the junior, very freshman senator from Arizona, right, about this. The headline ends up being Obama's Iran deal may lead to nuclear war. Let me just read you a bit of what Jeffrey Goldberg says from his interview with Tom Cotton. Of course, he's the person who drafted the letter that went to Iranian leaders saying that the Senate was going to have some say over this final deal. We'll talk about that in a minute. But though he pays lip service to the notion that the alternative to this deal is not war but a stronger deal, Cotton clearly appears to believe that an American or Israeli-initiated military confrontation soon, one that would not resemble the Iraq War, he thinks, but instead would be a strike of short duration and limited regional fallout, could prevent a nuclear confrontation sometime in the years to come. Quote, if we agree to the kind of proposal the Obama administration has made, then military confrontation may be further off, but it might also be nuclear.
Well, first, let me take issue with Senator Cotton. I thought what he did with that letter to the Iranians was outrageous.
Which you did not sign.
Absolutely, and I just thought it was just wrong, and it served no useful purpose. It undermined the President of the United States, and we should never be doing that. Let me also point out there's no such thing as a short military engagement. We saw that when we went into Iraq, it was supposed to be a pretty brief visit. A decade later, we were still there. So I think we got to be very cautious as to the use of military. It may be the only choice that's available, but it should always be the last choice. So a diplomatic solution here is by far the best course to follow. And let me separate two issues here. One, how should Congress review the agreement? And secondly, the merits of the agreement. We will be getting briefings this week on the merits of the April 2nd agreement reached between the Iranians and the P5 plus one, that is our negotiating partners in the United States. And we'll take a look at that. To me, there are certain fundamentals. It has to provide enough time before Iran could break out with a nuclear weapon that we can discover it and take action that it can effectively prevent them from becoming a nuclear power. That, to me, is going to be the fundamental test. But that's not what we're debating this week in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We're debating what process Congress should use to evaluate that. And as I pointed out, Congress imposed the sanctions. Only Congress can permanently remove or modify the sanctions. So I think it's important that we have an orderly way to review those sanctions. What President Obama is pretty firm about, and I agree with him, Congress has no responsibility to approve the agreement. We have a responsibility to review the agreement. And we're working with the Corker bill to make sure that is the clear intent. The second part is that we know Iran's liable to cheat. They've cheated in the past. If they don't comply with their terms in the agreement, we want to have adequate notice so that we can reimpose the sanctions quickly. And that's the second part of the bill, which hasn't gotten as much attention. I think most people agree with that part of the bill. And we are working to see whether we can't get broader consensus on the process. On the merits of the agreement, let's wait and see what the president comes up with in June. But right now, we only know frameworks. Until we see the specifics, it's hard to evaluate.
Well, what's known as the Corker, you just referred to it as the Corker bill. I guess it was originally Menendez-Corker, it's still Corker-Menendez, right?
Actually, it was drafted by three senators, Senator Corker, Senator Menendez, and Senator Kaine of Virginia.
Okay. You so far have not supported that as it's written.
I support the purpose of the bill, but it contains provisions I think need to be modified.
Okay. Now, how does this compare to in the past? I don't know if you can think of an example of the president or the secretary of state joining other nations or even just our nation engaging in a deal of some kind with another country like this, that where the Senate does have some purview or not?
Well, again,
have we seen that before?
Well, what's happening in Iran is unprecedented in that Iran is a country where the United States, the Congress, imposed specific sanctions against Iran for their failure to comply with the international responsibilities on nonproliferation. So we took action. Congress took action not once, but on a couple of occasions. And these sanctions are imposed by Congress. We expect that if we reach an agreement, and if Iran complied with that agreement, there will be need for congressional action to deal with these sanctions, to remove them or to modify them. So we are going to have to be engaged. Therefore, Congress has a responsibility to review it. We don't have a responsibility to approve it. And I think you'll find that if we're able to reach an agreement, that'll be clear in the language of the Corker bill. What we have a responsibility to do is to review it. We may need to take action. We always have the right. We're the legislative branch. We're Article 1 in the Constitution. We have the power to pass laws. The president has the right to veto. We have the right to override. Ultimately, it's the Congress that determines the policies of this country. The president negotiates. We determine the policies. Congress has a responsibility to review, and if it thinks it's appropriate, to take action.
So the two things you'd like to see is the Senate obviously have some oversight when it comes to when sanctions end. And secondly, some way of telling what's going on over there. As far as inspections go.
Yes. I worded a little bit differently than that. I think Congress has a responsibility.
You have to use my
words. The second point is to know what's going on and be able to take action. But the first is to review what the administration does, recognizing that we're going to have a role to play, and do we want to take action or not? to do that in an orderly way rather than wondering where Congress is on every appropriation bill or National Defense Authorization Act. Let's have a vehicle that expresses the congressional desires. Hopefully, and I mean this sincerely, I hope that the Congress and the administration are together. We always speak stronger as a nation when we're united.
What about Israel? Israel's leaders say no deal. They oppose any kind of deal with Iran on its nuclear program.
Well, we share the exact same objectives. I've had a chance to talk to Israeli intelligence as well as U.S. intelligence, as well, by the way, as the international inspectors in Vienna and their intelligence operations. And I think we all share the same basic concern about Iran becoming a nuclear weapon state and how far along they are in that process and what is necessary to be at a safe level from them attaining a nuclear weapon. The Israelis have a different view as to where they would like to end up, but I think we all agree that we have to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear weapon state. So, you know, we understand that, and there's still very close relationships between the intelligence communities between Israel and the United States. We share a lot of information. We're going to continue to do that. We're going to continue this close relationship between our two countries. And at the end of the day, we want to make sure that not only Israel, but the region is safe from the influence of a nuclear weaponed Iran.
You know, Senator Cardin, when I asked before about an administration working out a deal with another country and what role the Senate played in that, because I'm looking at this episode, and I go back to this young senator, Tom Cotton, and his letter signed by himself and 46 other senators to the leaders of Iran in the midst of these negotiations the Secretary of State's been carrying out. I scratch my head and I wonder, what's the sudden interest in this anyway? Why this particular issue? Why this position? And some people have said, you know, that this letter, I don't know if they use the word treason, but it certainly goes beyond what we've seen in the past. You know, the phrase about how politics is supposed to end at the water's edge. The president used that the other day. What's going on here? This is like, you know, the New York Times had an editorial yesterday saying this is part of an effort to delegitimize President Obama that's been going on since he took office.
There's no way that you can justify, explain, or find any logic in the letter that was sent and signed by 47 senators to the leaders of Iran. It was counterproductive. It undermined the United States. We were negotiating at the time. We're still negotiating. It made no sense.
Well, what's it about? Is it what the New York Times said? Delegitimizing the president?
I'm having a hard time understanding why certain senators signed that letter, who I know and respect greatly. I don't know Senator Cotton that well, so I have no idea the motivation. He's a new member of the United States Senate. Mm-hmm. What motivated him to take the leadership on this? But it clearly was not a fine moment for the United States Senate, and certainly not for the Republicans in signing that letter.
So today you're working on, there's going to be a draft. We're going to see a draft of something tomorrow from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Is that right?
The schedule is for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to meet tomorrow to mark up the Corker bill. It is our hope, we're not there yet, that Senator Corker and I would introduce a manager's amendment that would incorporate certain agreed to changes that would make this bill, I hope, accomplishes two principal purposes, but without the language that could be offensive to the president and the strength of his negotiations.
One last thing. I think just a few days ago, we had the Ayatollah weigh in on this, and the word pessimistic was used. He seemed to dismiss the idea of inspections in the country as part of this arrangement. What effect or influence do you think that'll have on this?
I don't trust Iran at all. I don't trust anything they ever say. So this agreement will be judged by what the requirements are, the ability of inspectors to determine whether Iran is in compliance, and the ability to take action if Iran cheats. That's going to be not what the Ayatollah says about the agreement or what spins people put on it.
Well, you can have an agreement, but if the Ayatollah is saying, no, this part I can't agree to—
I'm not going to...
He doesn't sign the document, but...
Well, they have their own spin operations in Iran, and that's something that we can't change.
Oh, the politics of Iran.
Right,
yeah,
but it's going to be the terms of the agreement, the ability to inspect to make sure they're carrying out the terms, that it works from the point of view of preventing Iran from becoming a nuclear weapon state, and if they cheat, we can take action immediately to reimpose sanctions and do what we need to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear weapon state. That's the key, not what the Ayatollah says about it, not what we say about it. It's what, in fact, happens.
Senator Ben Cardin is our guest on Midday in this hour. Please give us a ring if you have a comment, a question for Ben Cardin, 410-662-8780. I also get a chance to follow up today on a discussion we had last week on Senator Cardin's proposal for a federal tax reform, federal tax overhaul, his progressive consumption tax. We're going to talk about that a little bit in this hour. I have some follow-up questions from our panelists who discussed it for an hour last week. And also we'll talk a little bit of politics with Marco Rubio now, followed getting into the race, the senator from Florida, Hillary Clinton, announcing yesterday, long-anticipated announcement, that she'd be the Democratic candidate again for president, and Rand Paul, who announced last week. So a little bit of politics with Senator Cardin in this hour of Midday. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Again, our phone number, 410-662-8780. Back on Midday with Senator Ben Cardin. Again, our phone number, if you have a question about the Iran nuclear agreement, about the consumption tax that we discussed last week, or if you want to talk politics with Senator Cardin or anything else that might be on your mind, 410-662-8780 is our number. Can you hear me okay? Senator Cardin, can you hear me?
I hear you fine.
You hear me fine. All right. Let's see. Well, one last thing about, for me anyway, on Iran. We'll take some calls from our listeners here. President Obama, we're going to talk a little bit. He said this is historic, and an historic agreement that's been worked out. And I was talking before about that New York Times editorial on Republican efforts to delegitimize the president. And this was another example, this letter from Tom Cotton and the 46 others. I don't know if we speak enough about what President Obama has done when it comes to foreign policy, or a member of the now ranking Democrat in the Foreign Relations Committee. You talk a little bit about
sure.
How the president and his administration handled this, and also our approach to the ISIS crisis in Syria and in Iraq.
Well, there's never been a president that I've agreed with everything about his foreign policy. I do believe in the separation of our branches and that Congress has a role. I think we have to work as a united country on foreign policy issues, and it's important that we find ways to do that. But I do think President Obama deserves a great deal of credit. For many years, our policies in Iran were leading towards Iran becoming a nuclear weapon state. They were getting closer and closer and closer. And it was President Obama who was able to engage Iran and at least freeze their current progress as we negotiate, hopefully, an effective agreement that prevents them from becoming a nuclear weapon state. The jury's still out on this, but at least he's given us hope that we can find a diplomatic answer where in the past we have not been able to do that. In regards to Syria and what happened there, he was able to get the chemical weapons out of Syria. Give him credit for being able to do that without sending in American troops to for that to happen. He's been able to get an international coalition together to fight ISIS. ISIS is an extreme group, and recognizing that we have to cut off their support base in both Iraq and in Syria, and we need ground support, but it can't be U.S. ground support. And he's been able to build that type of an operation.
It seems like that operation is going to be long term.
Absolutely it is. And it's costly to the United States because of our air support and training missions. But we don't have troops on the ground. And I think our partners in that region are very appreciative of U.S. leadership. I had a chance to meet with King Abdullah of Jordan not too long ago, who said, look, getting rid of ISIS is our responsibility. You can't make it a Western crusade. We've got to do it ourselves, but we can't do it without your help. And President Obama's giving us the help that we need as far as air support and training. So I think the president's policies have been effective in dealing with these issues. Could it be stronger? Could we do better? That's subject to debate. But I do think it's unfair to criticize his engagement where his engagement has, and at times, made us safer as a country.
As far as the military presence in Afghanistan, what about that? You're not surprised to see that more time was needed?
I'm not surprised. I'm disappointed. I don't. I did not support keeping our troops in Afghanistan. I did support the original mission when we were attacked. I never supported putting our ground troops into Iraq. I still think that was a mistake, and historically, that it will be proven to be correct.
410-662-8780 is our phone number. If you have a question for Senator Ben Cardin, Bob in Parkville, thanks for calling. Go right ahead with your question, please.
Yes, everyone seems to be worried about the Iranians having the ability to refine the uranium to the point where they can make a fission bomb, but aren't we leaving them with plenty of uranium that they could just make dirty bombs, which would be just as devastating?
First, I have not been subject yet to the classified briefings on the April 2nd agreement. We will have those briefings, I believe, as early as tomorrow. So I will be getting specific information. But from what's been released from the White House, it looks like that we have inspectors at every level of the production, from the mining to the refinement to the actual use. So from what I can gather by the outline presented by the administration, that could not happen because we would have eyes on the process. We know exactly what they mined and what they've done with the mined plutonium or uranium.
Fred in Baltimore, go right ahead. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Good, great show. I just want to applaud Senator Cardin for his vision and bipartisanship in trying to work out a deal with Senator Corker. But the Republicans overlooked a couple of really key points here. One, Iran was the chief winner of the Iraq War, probably the most biggest strategic mistake in U.S. history made by Bush and Cheney. Second, this isn't just an agreement between the U.S. and Iran. It's an agreement with the United States, all permanent five members of the U.N. and Germany, probably two-thirds of the world's economy. And thirdly, Democrats never undertook to undermine President Reagan or President George Bush Sr. when they were negotiating with the Soviet Union over hundreds of nuclear weapons and a country that was a much graver threat. That's about all I need to say.
Thank you, Fred.
Well, I think the point is well taken. You take a look at our negotiating partners, which include Russia and China, and to be able to maintain the tough sanctions against Iran during this entire period and have unity among all the negotiating partners as to the objective of preventing Iran from becoming a nuclear weapon state and following that strategy, that's not an easy task, just keeping our coalition partners together. And the president's been able to do that through this whole process. I remember when we started this, there were the naysayers who said that we would never be able to maintain the sanctions. We have maintained the sanctions. So I think the president does deserve credit for how he's managed the international community.
I want to move on to a consumption tax. To bring this home to a domestic issue, you've been working on tax reform, thinking about it, talking about it for a long time, going back to the time that you were in the House of Representatives. So let's talk a little bit about this. I introduced this subject last week on the air, and we had an hour-long discussion about Senator Ben Cardin's proposal to overhaul the federal tax system with a consumption tax, and a consumption tax that would impart, would mean that millions of Americans, most Americans, would not file income taxes, but would pay consumption or added value or sales tax, a federal sales tax on goods. So there's my brief summation of what it is, of the highlights of it anyway. It would lower the business tax, the corporate tax, too, to 17%. There would still be income tax for people over $100,000 in household income. Just those are the highlights there.
Sure.
But what got you to this,
to
consumption tax?
Well, I think as we get very close to April 15th and all of us are struggling to figure out what our tax code means, I dare say that many people who are paying income taxes are saying, am I being treated fairly? And they don't think they are. They think people get breaks that they should get or can't get or shouldn't be taking or are taking, and that our tax code, too many people of high income are finding ways to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. We all heard the story of why these money managers are making millions and billions of dollars and paying at rates, marginal rates, lower than what their support staff make. I think it raises serious questions as to the fairness of our tax code internally among Americans. But then when you look at the international impact, the fact that we are not competitive, our marginal rates mean that companies are locating their operations outside the United States because of tax consequences, you have to wonder, because the United States, among the industrial nations, has a lower reliance on governmental services, and yet our marginal tax rates are higher. That makes no sense at all. So what I want to do is to really reform our tax code. We tried to do this in 86 using just income taxes. It lasted till 87 when Congress changed it, and there have been 10,000 changes to the tax code since 1986. Many are just temporary in nature, causing all types of uncertainty among taxpayers and their actions. So the only way I think we can reform our tax code to be fair and make it competitive is to look at what's going on around the world and harmonize more with the international tax regimes. And internationally, just about every country, every industrial country other than the United States, uses a national consumption tax.
Or a value-added tax.
A value-added tax is a national consumption tax.
A tax on goods and services at every step of the...
Every step of the way. You've got to pay it. You can't avoid it.
Of commerce, right?
Right.
Okay.
Two complaints. It hits the poor harder. I've corrected that by removing people with under 100,000, families with under 100,000 from paying any income taxes and giving rebates based upon your income and family size that equal, in some cases exceed, the consumption taxes you would otherwise have to pay. So it will be fairer to low and middle income families than our current tax code. Second major criticism, you're layering a new tax on, more tax burdens for Americans. I have a circuit breaker, which is an automatic tax rebate if the tax receipts go above the stated amount. So I think I've handled the two major criticisms of a consumption tax and are able to make our tax code much more competitive and fairer to Americans.
Let's just talk about the circuit breaker for a minute. So your circuit breaker is or says if revenues exceed 10% of GDP, gross domestic product, we will rebate the overage to the American people. So if you're in low or moderate income, middle income, and you're paying consumption taxes during the course of the year, at the end of the year, what, you get a rebate check from the government?
It's an equal amount to every eligible taxpayer,
Everybody.
Everybody who's paid, who has had to file a tax return, a form, whether to qualify for a rebate or to pay taxes.
All right. So you still have to file a return?
Well, you're going to have to file informational returns in order to be able to get the rebates. So you have to file, but that's not a
You have to declare your income to the government.
So the government has your income, yes.
Okay. How would your progressive consumption tax interact with state and local income and sales taxes? This is a question from Michael Reich, professor from the University of Maryland School of Social Work, who was on our panel last week.
It would have no impact on the sales tax. The consumption tax is a very visible tax added to the final cost, as is the retail sales tax. So it would have no impact. We already have multiple taxes on many transactions. If you rent a car at the airport or pay a hotel bill, you see multiple taxes. So it will not impact at all the collection of sales taxes. In regards to the income tax collections, it would affect states because the information, like Maryland, is taken from the federal return. We're going to have less people using the federal return. We simplify the federal return dramatically by only allowing four major deductions. So it would have an impact. The state would have to develop either its own income tax system or harmonize with the federal.
Above $100,000 of household income, the tax rate is something. What did you have it as? 15, 20?
Above 100,000, zero up to the first 100,000
right.
family. Then it starts at 15%. It graduates up to 28% for income over $500,000.
Okay. Another question here from Michael Reich as well. How would the progressive consumption tax encourage savings among low-earning households who have insufficient income to save?
Well, there is a problem with savings. There's no question in America. We do have ways that we try to help people save by certain incentives. The real thing about this tax code, it rewards savings. To the extent that you save, you're not paying any consumption taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Taxes is not based on your income; it's based on your consumption. So if you don't consume, you pay less taxes. If you save, you get a reward. We also do not tax the appreciation of savings. So that also is tax-free.
Here's a question from another one of our panelists, Senator. This is Barbara Morgan, who's a lecturer in economics at Johns Hopkins University. As you've just stated, one argument for switching to a consumption tax is that the current system is broken and very, very complicated. Yet your proposal does include a reform and simplification of the income tax. Why don't we just make changes on the income tax side by getting rid of loopholes, by retaining the four big deductions that you just mentioned that favor high earners, keeping the marginal tax rates we now have for everyone, and lowering corporate tax rates? After all, she says, the income tax is not that complicated or expensive for the majority of filers who file a 1040 in a couple of days, by a couple of days. In addition, there are considerable transition costs to moving to a new system. For example, senior citizens would lose out under your proposal. Anyway, so why not just...
Well, no, I understand the issue. The problem is that because we've tried to make the income tax progressive, we have a lot of bells and whistles in it.
Right.
And because of high income, you have bells and whistles. They figure out ways to take advantage of it where ordinary taxpayers cannot. I would agree if we could go to a simplified tax, but the problem is the rates are going to be so high in order to produce the revenue that it's going to be hard to hold on to it. And past experience has shown us that Congress can't. So unless you really make a significant change in the way we collect revenues, I think our past history shows that we'll be back to amending it, changing it, making it temporary, and higher income people will always figure out ways to avoid taxes.
Try this question, also from Barbara Morgan. How does this proposal, compared to the system we currently have, affect income inequality? What would be the share of the top 1% in overall income under this proposal? Is this proposal meant to address, because the word progressive is in your act,
yes,
is it meant to address income inequality?
I think it's the foundation for addressing income inequality. The question is a great question because we do have income inequality in America. It's growing. It's not getting better. It's getting worse. The haves and have-nots are becoming much, much wider than in any time in America's history. And we see a shrinking middle class, which is not good for a growing economy. So that we need to deal with. Our tax code makes it very difficult for us today to have the tools necessary to deal with income inequality. I would suggest that this type of a tax code would give us the foundation so that we can address those issues by having an orderly budget process where you can make real budget decisions. We're spending more in the tax code than we spend in all of the discretionary appropriation bills in this country.
What do you mean we're spending in the tax code?
We spend $1.3, $1.4 trillion a year in hemorrhaging tax revenues because of tax breaks.
I see.
We appropriate $1.2 trillion a year, something like that, for defense and non-defense discretionary spending. So we're spending more in the tax code than we do in the spending bills. I'd rather have it on the spending side where we can directly deal with the type of problems that question is aimed at, and we should. But this tax code really makes it difficult to do it.
Tell us what you think of Senator Cardin's proposal for a consumption tax. 410-662-8780. We'll entertain questions about that and also about the Iran nuclear deal when we come back. A short break here. More with Senator Cardin on Midday. Again, our email address, midday@wypr.org, and you can reach us by phone, 410-662-8780. Here's an email from Frank in Hampstead. Let's be honest on the corporate tax rate. No corporation ever pays the full rate. There are plenty of deductions that lower the overall rate. Further, these corporations are able to do business around the world because the U.S. is there to make sure the sea lanes are open and the rule of law is followed, and yet the businesses complain they have to pay taxes. Instead of complaining, they should look at it as a cost of doing business instead of asking the individual taxpayer to subsidize their business costs and their operations. There's a story out today, a couple of points here that off of Frank's email. There's a story out today about a study, I think this is from the University of California, Berkeley, taking a look at the number of working Americans, a number of Americans who live in households where someone is working, the head of household is working, employed, and still receiving benefits through our social safety net, you know, food stamps or Medicaid or whatever it is, a housing subsidy of some kind.
Right.
And it's something like three-quarters of the households that receive some benefit of one of those benefits has a head of household employed. In other words, the working poor. This is a measure of the working poor in the United States. So, you know, you have people working for companies that are basically, you could argue, being subsidized by the government by supporting their workers because they don't pay them enough. You know, that's something that occurred to me today when I was thinking about asking you again about this consumption tax, that, you know, people who are low, moderate income, already stressed, they may see this as a regressive tax on them. They may not see the benefit of that.
Well, first, in regards to the corporate rates.
Yeah.
The corporate rates.
Although Frank's email, yeah.
The corporate rates are high. The marginal rates are high. Do all corporations pay at the marginal rate? No. But some do pay at the marginal rates, particularly the multinational companies. And as a result.
You mean like 34%, 35%?
Yes. 35% is which is the highest rate.
Yeah.
And the problem is it's a U.S. company. They have international operations. They earn money overseas. They pay at a much lower corporate rate overseas. So they then have this money that they've earned that they like to bring back to the United States. They can't bring it back without paying the differential tax. So if they paid a 15% tax overseas, they now bring it back to the United States, there would be a 20% additional tax. They get a credit for the 15%, but they have to pay 20% to bring it back. That's before they issue dividends and then subject to more taxes after dividends.
Mm-hmm.
So they look at it and say, gee, it's not worth it. The proof is that we got trillions of dollars literally trapped overseas of U.S. corporation money that they don't repatriate because of the marginal tax rate.
And you say reduce it to 17 and you'll see more of it?
Oh, absolutely. 17% would be 5 points below the industrial nation's average on corporate taxes. So we would have a competitive advantage with our rates. That'd be no problem at all. That money would be back here in the United States at a 17% rate. So it is an issue. On the second point about benefits being paid, aren't we subsidizing companies?
Well,
that's the problem you said earlier. The problem is income inequality in America. When you have working families that can't make it today, there's something wrong. Working families are falling behind. We see productivity increase, but that productivity increase has not been translated into higher salaries for working families. That's a fundamental problem that we have to deal with. It's not the tax code, but it's a fundamental issue we have to deal with.
410-662-8780 is our number here. A constituent call, Gene and Easton on the Eastern Shore. A question for your junior senator from Maryland, Ben Cardin. Gene, go right ahead.
Hello. I'm a little nervous. Sorry.
That's all right.
I work at the Staples Copy Print Center, and now we're required to be a United States postal provider in addition.
Huh.
We have multiple copy print responsibilities at $9.11 an hour. Why should I have to process United States Post Office, UPS, mail, in addition to my other responsibilities with no benefits? I'm on Obamacare, when if one works for the post office and basically I'm doing the same thing, you make much more. We're poorly trained. I believe that safety of the U.S. mail is at risk. I was just wondering if you could comment on that, please, because and in a sense, when you're talking about lower wage workers, the United States Post Office is adding to that problem.
Hmm.
Well, thank you for your question, and thank you for what you're doing every day. A couple responses. First, part of this is the employer you're working for and the arrangements that they are making, and I do believe in corporate responsibility, and I won't make a value judgment here, but it seems to me with the responsibilities you're carrying out, that wage seems too low. I'm just giving you my own personal view with the responsibilities you're carrying out. Now, as far as the fundamental question you raise, and that is a responsibility of government being handled by the private sector, I'm in total agreement. I've led a fight in Congress to stop what we call private contracting out of governmental services. Governmental services should be performed by government workers, with the oversight and accountability of being part of the government structure, so we can appropriate it directly and manage it directly. I think contracting out is counterproductive and ends up costing the taxpayers more money. We've seen it over and over again. So if postal service work is being done by the private sector in an effort to have lower wage workers do it, at the end of the day, we lose the control and the accountability that we need. It should be done by government workers with the protection of government service.
You know, you said earlier that you don't think income inequality can be addressed through tax policy.
I think you can. You don't want to make it worse. You can reward working families, but you. I think you can't deal with the fundamental issues of why workers aren't getting the benefits of productivity increases through the tax code.
Okay. Well, then, what is the leverage of Congress when it comes to this? If Congress wished to do something about it,
well, there are different areas, and we talked about minimum wage. We haven't talked today, but minimum wage increases, making sure it keeps up with wage inflation, so that we don't fall behind on the minimum wage, paid leave.
Well, where are we with that?
Well, there will be a bill filed very shortly. Our leadership in the Senate is working on a bill to adjust the federal minimum wage.
You mean the Democrats?
The Democrats
are working on it.
I'm not.
Okay.
That we'll see what the Republicans decide to do. Although this I must tell you, we've seen a lot of Republican states that have acted on minimum wage increases. So I think this is an area where Democrats and Republicans may be able to come together. Paid leave. We're finally recognizing that there is a need for paid leave. That would help working families to deal with their issues. Pay equity, paycheck fairness, making sure that women aren't discriminated in the workplace. That would help working families. There's a lot of issues that we can deal with. Making higher education more affordable is a huge issue for middle-income families. The president's proposal for 2 years of community college to be free. These are all proposals that help working families deal with the cost of education. We've already dealt with the cost of health care in the Affordable Care Act. We need to strengthen that. So, yes, there's a lot of programs, but the tax code can help, but we got to look at some of the more fundamental issues.
Sandy in Howard County, our next caller with a question for Senator Cardin. Hi.
Hello, Senator Cardin. I'd like to ask you about, as I understand it, your proposal would include taxes on food and medical expenses, and I would consider that to be a truly regressive step to take. I believe that several nearby states do not tax food. This would have the greatest impact on people with the lowest incomes. And
well,
I would like to know.
Let's ask a senator about whether. Okay, I'm sorry, Sandy. We've got a shorter time here.
So I was going to say.
This is a criticism that it's regressive.
It's a regressive. On all goods and services, if you make exemptions, then you're going to have loopholes. This is on all goods and services. So, yes, it's on food. Yes, it's on medicine. But if you are a person who has modest income, let's say you make $50,000 a year, just use that family of four, you're going to get rebates. You're not going to pay part of what you spend, $50,000 on food, parts on medicine. You are paying extra taxes, but you're going to get a cash rebate that will, in some cases, be more than all the taxes you're paying, because right now you're getting an earned income tax credit. You're getting a child credit. We convert that into cash. So you get that cash up front. You don't have to lay out the money. You get it up front. So at the
That's
end
if
of
you're
the,
low income.
If you are lower income on your earned income, you get the same benefits you get today under the earned income tax credit. So, yes, if you are of a lower income. So, yes, and you're also paying no income taxes today. So you need to compare people of comparable income. And what I'm saying, people of comparable income will pay no more taxes under the consumption and income taxes than they're paying today.
Does that help you, Sandy?
Perhaps it does. I still feel that there are some people, particularly in the very lowest incomes, who will not even know how to fill out the forms that would be needed to get the rebate. That would be difficult. If they don't know themselves, they would have to pay a tax preparer, for example.
But let me just answer. If you're at the lowest income, the answer is even simpler, because we adjust the benefits to reflect the higher cost. So food stamps, for example, would be increased to cover the extra cost of the consumption tax.
Hmm. All right. Thank you very much, Charlie and Falston. We'll go to you next. Hi.
Yes, I have a question. I heard, I don't know if it's true or not, but I was told that people that come here from other countries and start up a small business pay no taxes income for X amount of years. And I just wondered if that is really true.
You stumped me on that. I'm not aware of any special breaks for companies coming in from other countries. I'm not aware of that.
You mean someone who comes here as a documented immigrant or becomes a naturalized citizen or not?
Well, they come here and they live here and lived here for years. And they just start up a business and and sometimes I was told.
Yeah, I'm not aware of this. I do know that we have programs for American citizens, small business operators, to help them get started in businesses. We have loan programs. We have technical assistance. But that's U.S. citizens.
All right, Senator Carr, a little bit of politics here. So Hillary Clinton's long-anticipated announcement came over the weekend in the form of a video. I'm sure you expected her to run for president again.
Yes.
This is no surprise to you.
It was not a surprise.
So what did you think of the way she rolled it out, what she had to say, calling herself, saying that Americans need a champion for everyday Americans?
I think she's right. I think that message is what we were talking about a little bit earlier. I think that working families today are hurting. They need someone who is going to be sensitive to try to make sure that that working families have a better shot. And I think that her message was clear about that. I'm still getting used to people making an announcement through the internet rather than doing it in person. But that's today how announcements are made. I think Hillary is going to excite a huge Democratic base and beyond throughout the country.
So is the primary over then, pretty much, today?
I think she's a very, very heavy favorite.
I don't know who would challenge her at this point, because our former governor, Martin O'Malley, has been out there sort of campaigning, visiting states, early primary states.
The governor's doing that, and I think he's getting very positive response. And I think people like Governor O'Malley a great deal. I just think that Senator Clinton, Secretary Clinton, is going to be a very heavy favorite to get the nomination.
Okay, and to get the nomination, and then the general election. We have Rand Paul, who announced last week. Ted Cruz had announced before that. Today, Marco Rubio. I guess we're expecting to hear Jeb Bush announce. So
we still have 97 senators. You haven't heard from
them. Haven't heard from yet.
Yes.
I don't know if you want to speculate a little bit about this, but I mean, what do you think of the message that Democrats have to have going into 2016, given the way people feel about Congress in general, the economy coming back a little bit now, unemployment down at 5.6%.
Well, quite frankly, I think the messages from the Republicans who are interested are pretty different messages. I mean, you got I don't think that you would say that Senator Cruz and Governor Bush are saying the same message. If they are, I would find that somewhat.
No, they're quite far apart. Actually.
Right. So I think they're going to have a pretty interesting primary. I think it'll be a divisive primary. I'm not sure we're going to know who the Republican nominee is going to be for a while. I think on the Democratic side, it's going to be a much clearer message. We are really there fighting for middle-income families. We want them to have a better shot. We want to deal with their everyday needs. We want to increase the share of productivity increases that are going to working families. That's going to be our central message, and I think Secretary Clinton will deliver that message pretty clearly. On the Republican side, I'm not sure what they have other than they don't like President Obama.
Steve in Thurmont, we'll let you have the final word. We only got about a minute left, Steve, so go right ahead for the senator.
Oh, hey, Senator Dan. Just like to say, I really, really like your plan as far as taxing the consumption. I think it puts great pressure on instead of
on income. I guess we lost Steve there. It sounds
I was hoping he would continue.
It sounds like a thumbs up on your consumption tax
idea.
Right.
I have to make sure I get Steve's number. I might need him later.
Do we have time for Jerry in Port Deposit? That needs to be real short, Jerry.
Yes, I'm here.
Just have to keep it real brief. What did you want to say about the consumption tax?
I wanted to say that a lot of lower-income people are worried about a value-added tax costing more on the end of food and that sort of thing. And I actually think it'll be beneficial and be progressive because it'll help shorten the supply chain between where we grow our food and where people will actually buy it, even if it is taxed.
Yeah, we talked about that last week when Ken Solo was here, also from Pinnacle Advisory, who's one of our panelists, and talked about how value added works through the whole process of making a loaf of bread. And Jerry's on to something.
Much more efficient way of collecting.
You mean if you're, it's a much more efficient way of collecting, but what she's saying, it might discourage. Make the processing of food more direct, more local, and maybe cut down on the amount of taxes that are paid at each step of the way. Thank you very much for being here, Senator Ben Cardin.
Thank you, Dan.
Nice to have you on the show. And please enjoy lunch from Rosina Gourmet. Since 1999, Rosina Gourmet has served handmade, locally sourced ingredients for their sandwiches, soups, salads, and vegetarian items. More information at rosinagourmet.com.